that the majority in the Latino community would be Mexican, would not be Puerto Rican. And there's 49% African American in Humboldt Park. And so how Wheelers presented, Humboldt Park also goes all the way to Cicero, way far. And so Wheelers would have you think that Humboldt Park stops at California, if you know the streets, which is where things are being gentrified. And so Realtors will have you believe that that is Humboldt Park. And in essence, that's still, if you look at a geographic map, there's 77 geographic areas in Chicago, that's actually Westtown, not Humboldt Park. However, Realtors have that as their sort of descriptor of what that community is. Matter of fact, I think I saw something in the paper today that Humboldt Park is one of the hottest homes are selling. It's one of the hottest markets right now. You know,
it's the realtor, like the holding companies that buy realty and then hope that in 10 years it's going to turn around. It's actually the highest amount of properties being bought by corporations to gentrify, basically.
You're right. Right. And you know what's so interesting about Humboldt Park, that if you know the history of even how Puerto Ricans who lived in this area moved further west, because Fort DePaul is here and Bercy, that was basically Puerto Rican. So that is a descriptor. Foundations. So foundations describe communities. So if you go into it, I'm going to see if we can get somebody from Foundation, a program officer to come here, but foundations have their way of describing communities because that's how they get money away. They have to have a descriptor. Where do they get that description from? Universities. Us. Researchers. We make it authentic. You know, so foundations come to universities to get the descriptors on what communities look like, to make it authentic. CPS have catchment areas of what their community. So if you say that in Harper High School, which is in Inglewood, it's really in West Inglewood. And their catchment area is not all of Inglewood, it's only maybe the surrounding 4 or 5 blocks. Right? And so when you think about developers, outside agencies, like if, as you put in your nonprofits together, coming to communities, oftentimes you say, well, I'm servicing Inglewood. But what does that mean? There's Inglewood and West Inglewood. Now, if you go into Inglewood, I'm just using this as an example, and say that I'm setting up my nonprofit in West Inglewood, people who live in that community don't look at it. They don't think about it as West Inglewood or Inglewood. They think of it as one. They think of it as Inglewood. So really understanding the stories of what people on the ground know. It's not just what statistics tell you, but what are the stories that are happening? And we'll talk a lot about stories because from an asset-based analysis, it's about the stories. You have to know the stories of people who live in those communities. You can go to the next one. Understanding communities. In every community, communities have their own swag. They just do. They have their own culture, they have their own belief systems, social norms, traditions. Particularly ones that has been together over time. How many people have been into South Chicago? South Chicago, so I'm talking about by the lake, where the factories used to be, where the steel mills. What's your impression of South Chicago? And I can give you mine.
How
do you feel when you're there?
It's very industrial, and I feel like it's just a lot of, there's like half and half, half of the people are from that neighborhood and live there, and the other half are people that came, I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, I've been there only once, but I think just like the buildings are kind of old and it's kind of dirty. It's just like, it's not like, you know, this area. So it's
You feel it's like it's got an old feel,
yeah,
to it, right? Old,
yeah,
world,
old,
yeah.
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 Well, like, it depends on how far south you go, but like, there are some sense that kind of reminds you of like company towns, like originally how, especially like American Steel,
right.
Steelcase came in, but also there's like still some very large buildings, like 73rd Street, like really like part of the White City, which is like very magnificent, and they're not utilized. Empty things that are just kind of growing vines on the cracking. It's like sad, but also like very historic. And also like real like people, well, I don't know.
No, I mean, that's a good description.
Yeah, kind of just like coming up with people said, it feels like you're stepping back in time.
Bam.
And it feels like it's the forgotten. It's like, am I in Chicago anymore? Because this just does not feel like the rest of the city. You just feel this old, like you're in the middle of time warp or something.
Anachronism. Yeah, that's what that's called. Yeah, yeah. And that's exactly you captured how I feel. I love that place. You know, that's where the steel mills were. It's 7 miles of steel mills, which, if we're in the next 20 years, that's going to be the new lakefront. That's going to be the
Isn't that still zoned commercial? And are there still brownfields there?
There's brownfields, but there's brownfields. Right.
I've heard that there's plans for like the Calumet River area to come and like build more green space and like make it like a corridor for migrating species. That's what I've heard. I don't know if there's a lot of active work going on to make that happen, but
there is. I think there's the development company there has been very active with the community, but they don't have a lot of community-based organizations that are moving that. They're trying to keep their homes there, you know. So that's what they're afraid of in that community. But you're right. It feels like an anachronism that time has passed. But it is also a feeling that it feels, you know, you got cobblestone roads, for God's sake, you know, still there. You got trolleys. And sometimes you feel like you're in Europe. You know, it's really interesting. But you also, it's a sector where you have what they call the quadrums, where you have four sectors that young people don't cross. They just don't cross. I haven't seen anything like this in my life, where they won't literally cross the street going into the next quadrum. And that's because of gangs that are entrenched there. You have African Americans who populate the Latino gangs more than Latinos, you know? It's a very interesting upside down sort of place, but it's fascinating. So if you get the opportunity, you should visit the best restaurants, really, really interesting space over there. So understanding community, and all communities have social networks. So what I mean by social networks is that we come in and we assume that how these folk communicate. How do they know what's happening? And, you know, at the end of the block, how do they know what's happening in these communities? But there's existing social networks. So never assume that people don't talk to one another. Never assume that you're creating, because you're building a social capital, that people are already. People have been doing that forever. It might be informal, but it's real. There is real life social networks. So if you're going to set up a community garden, you know, let's use this as an example. Let's use Inglewood. You're into environmental justice stuff. They set up a community garden in Inglewood. Won't name names, you know, but Something happened in that community that wasn't good with that particular garden. It wasn't blast, it wasn't on blast, it wasn't, you know, posters posted, but it went social. These networks, these informal networks happened where we're not shopping there. We're not going there. We're not going to You know what I'm saying? So there's an assumption that these things don't happen, but they're alive and well. History. I'm big in history because every community has a story to tell. They all have stories to tell. And so to understand, that's why I opened up last week to really understand, you know, what the Egan is about. Okay, what is the Egan? Who remembers? I'm not going to ask you some that. What Egan? When I was talking about the Egan Center. See, history only lasts 1 week, right? So, what base? Go ahead.
I mean, it's about Father Egan, about how his hands are so big because it describes his impact and how many people he reached and
right.
His activist.
That's right. That's right. So the center that I run was named after Father Egan. And Father Egan was an activist priest. I'm just going to be blunt. And he was a mover and a shaker in a time when people of the cloth wasn't doing exactly the things that he was doing. And his focus was around dealing with equality around housing, education. And so that's the center that I've run for years. And so that's the impetus of the work that we do. And so it's important. So when you see that statue out there, I'm not saying pay homage to the guy, you know, don't say that. But that's what he represents, and that's who he is. It's not a picture of, looks like, if you're a baseball fan, looks like maybe Harry Carey or something, I don't know. But it's not him, it's Father Egan. They call him Jack Egan. Next. Demographics. All communities, you know, understand the population age of these communities that you're going into, so that's homework. Never go into a community and you don't know the demographics. Never approach a community and you don't know the demographics. There's so much census data out there. I'm not saying that you have to drill down to every specific piece, but it's absolutely critical to understand demographics. Political structures. And we're living in Chicago. If you don't understand the politics, that's one strike against you. I'm not saying that you have to be a political junkie. But I'm saying that politics in Chicago guides, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, depends on your worldview, often guides what happens in these communities. It also impacts money that comes into your agencies. It just impacts the lives of the people in these communities. And so the political structures are also understanding power dynamics, which is not always the alderman who runs it. So if you understand stories that are happening in these communities, it could be Big Mama down the street who runs that block. You know, it could be a powerful pastor that nobody comes into that community unless you talk to Reverend whoever, right? It could be a powerful priest. It could be, but you don't, the assumption that people do make is that when you come into these communities, you start an organization and you go to what you call the stakeholder. But the stakeholder who's sort of on television all the time, or is what the papers say that, you know, you need to talk to Reverend whoever. But the people in the community think he's an idiot. Right? So it's not always the formal ones, but the informal ones, the ones that the people on the street know, you know, the ones that it could be the charismatic preacher who has a storefront church and he feeds the homeless. He's the man. You might not have the mega church, but understand that the mega church, the people who come to the mega church don't live in the community for the most part. So really understand these stakeholders are not always what they seem to be. So you always have to kind of look at these informal ways of getting to who really has power. Go back. All right, real quickly, so every community has its issues. You cannot go into communities and not know the issues that exist. So if you go into a community and you're starting up an environmental justice program, right? But is that what the community is stating is the real issue? Not to say I'm not putting anything against that because it should be up front, but is that what the community is stating as a real issue? What is the issue? You know, so really, really investigating what are issues that are happening, and oftentimes it's not what the paper is saying. It's okay, let's just use this as an example. I do a lot of, I never forget this, this is crazy as heck. I do a lot of work, I have an NGO that does work in South America and in Africa, so I remember years ago, I was working with this faith-based group, and they went ahead of me, and they went to this village, and everybody in the village, you know, didn't have shoes on, right? They didn't have shoes. And so they came back to the church and said, we got to get everybody in the village shoes. So they did this whole big shoe drive at the church, brought back hundreds of shoes, you know, just crazy boots, you know, understanding that it's like 100 degrees there. They had all kinds of moccasins and, you know, Nikes. But the issue, when they brought them back, of course they took them, but the issue was dysentery, was water. But what they saw as an assumption, you know, oh, these kids, they don't have no shoes on. Nobody has shoes on there, right? And so they got back. They were looking crazy. So we didn't address, they did not address the real issue. The issue was dysentery. The issue was unclean water. The wells weren't working right. But nobody asked them. Nobody asked them. They just came in there and did what they did what they assumed was the problem. Geographic boundaries, I talked a little bit about that. Really understand geographic boundaries. Really understand geographic boundaries. If you're in Chicago and you're doing work in this area, it doesn't really matter, but to really understand where communities stop and start, because that makes a big difference. I'll use Humboldt Park as an example. If you're in Humboldt Park, there's two Humboldt Parks. There's West Humboldt Park, and then there's Humboldt Park. Let's be clear about that. When you cross Pulaski, you're in a whole other world. I mean, if you know Pulaski, you know, it's a lot of undocumented. There is a large African-American community there, and Puerto Rican, and Dominican, and so, but they don't have the same structures that they do on the East End. Right, there's more resources, what we perceive resources on the East End. And so people on the west of Pulaski, what they call K, that's where the K streets begin, they would literally call themselves K-Town. They won't, and some, depending who you ask, if you ask a teenager, they say I live in K-Town. They won't say I live in Humboldt Park because they don't even want to associate that name. It's really fascinating. So the assumptions that we make is that we're in Humboldt Park, but you ask a young person, they'll say I live in K-Town. That's not even a geographic area called K-Town, but that's where the K streets begin. It's a fascinating process, and so geographic boundaries is absolutely important. Okay? And as I mentioned before, really understanding the stories of elders, or understanding stories. So when you come to communities, or when you come into spaces that you're trying to set up shop, if you will, really understand the stories. The stories. Who would you get your story? Who would you go and get stories from if you were to set up an educational enrichment center? Who would you and the community that you did all your research on? Who would you go and see and talk to?
Those being educated.
Who else? Don't have me to pick on y'all.
Maybe just the people who live there.
People who live there? Right. Who else? Let's pull that apart. People who live there, but people who live there for years and
elderly people?
Pardon?
Like old people?
Elderly people? Exactly. Oftentimes we don't even look at the elders as assets, do we? They're just there. Depending, especially in this country. Elders are just elders, right? But the elders hold the stories. The elders are the ones who sit on the porch. They see everything. The elders have seen generations go through. elders, his kids went through whatever they went through, but the elders hold the stories. If you get to the elders, you got the story of the community. If you get the elder to talk, that's rich. They can tell you what's happening. Okay, we can go through that. Go through that. Okay. So this is really important because this gets to what we did here. When you look at the communities that you work in, people often look at the needs. And so if you look at the needs, you're really thinking about it from a deficiency model, right? Because this community needs this. We got to come in and help. They need our help because there's a deficit. So oftentimes we focus on the deficiencies or the community needs when we come in. There are assumptions that we make. Assumptions are based often on press clippings. We need to come in and or sound bites that tells a drastic, horrible picture of what's going on in South Chicago or what's going on in Inglewood or what's going on in Austin or what's going on in Hermosa or wherever. And we, as our nonprofits, respond to this. We come in and save the day. That's public, private, and nonprofit human services supported by, guess what? The findings that universities, so university data, our research supports that this community doesn't have enough of this. This community doesn't have enough of that. And that data goes where? To foundations who pay us to go in to do the work. So it's this interesting money train that goes around. So you need this. And so we come in to create programs, and guess what? A lot of times those programs create dependency. And so we can have a long conversation about that, and I think we'll keep unpacking this, but do you understand what I'm saying, what it creates a dependency? No? Yes? Maybe so? I got puzzled looks. Okay, so what happens is that oftentimes is that when we come in with programs to fill this deficiency model, to really get in there and really address the needs of community, we're funded by foundations, public, private money, right? The people who live in that community begin to think that they really, really need you, which is not, in a lot of cases they do, right? That creates a client mentality, a consumer mentality, right? And that creates dependency. And we keep with this dependency because, you know, there's a money train to it. And I'm not saying it's all, you know, malicious or whatever. It just is. So we become clients, or the community becomes a client. And it comes to believe that the needs could only be addressed by someone from the outside. So outside is good. So somebody from the outside is going to come and fix our needs. Somebody from the outside is going to come and work with us to address our woes and some of our deficits. You go to the next one, Jim. And so community needs map would be for education. It's around illiteracy, unemployment, school closings, dropouts, lack of jobs, environmental issues, mental illness, teenage pregnancy, disease, lack of green space, abandoned buildings, foreclosed homes, homelessness, drugs, alcoholism, violence, gangs, crime. We can go on and on and on. Next one, Jeff. So, we recognize that when we come into communities and do this work or set up our not-for-profits, that the glass is half full. We should begin to recognize that because there's people, there's deficit in needs, but there's also people who live there who have skills and talents. Okay, so if you go past that. All right. One of the things I do want to talk about too, and this really begin to sort of have us think critically about, is that when we're setting up, and as you're setting up your own not-for-profits, really realizing your own privilege, what that looks like, understanding power dynamics as you sculpt your nonprofit positionality, bless you, and being able to be conscious of reflection and empathy. All right, this is a crazy picture. So, this is a community, oddly enough, that works. It looks crazy, it looks chaotic, but you got block clubs, you got community parties, people are, who said connected? You know, that's an example of what you were talking about. All these things are connected. You got businesses, you know, you got shared ideas, you got flea markets, and well, all these things, and they're all connected. So this is a connected, beginning of a connective tissue of connecting the dots in community. All right. So this would be kind of the baseline of some of the things that we're going to be learning as you set up your own nonprofits. It's really understanding what I call your ABCDs, and a lot of this is what we've been talking about, is asset-based community development. The model was put together by Kretzman and McKnight out of Northwestern many moons ago, but this model is used all over the world. And so for us, I'm not going to get too deep because it's, you know, but I want us to have just a general understanding. But asset base really rests on the principles of understanding and recognizing the strengths, the gifts, the talents, and assets of individuals who live in these communities. Let me say that again. The strengths, the gifts, the talents, and assets of individuals and that live in these communities, and being able to access that so positive results happen. All right, a quick asset map. I look at it as five tentacles. You guys are going to be doing one of them today. The first one is the skills of the local residents. Really recognizing the skills of the local residents. Everybody has a gift. Everybody has a talent. The power of associations. Okay? Does anybody know what I mean by when I say associations? All right, here's the deal. Associations are probably the lifeblood of what happens in communities. It's not the nonprofits, it's the associations. Associations are groups of people who get together on a common issue. They're not nonprofits because they don't have boards, they don't pay dues, they get together like it could be Tanner. Welcome, Tanner. It could be Tanner and his guys every Saturday. They get together with a group of young people and play basketball. Every Saturday, Tanner and his boys, they come and they get together, but the common theme is get these kids off the street, play ball. It could be the church Bible study or the choir. It could be the book club. It could be the garden club. They don't pay dues. It's not a, in associations, everybody lives in that community. You have to be from the community to be a part of the association. Associations are the lifeline or the lifeblood. And if you want to find out, I've talked about these formal and informal. The informal communication goes through these associations. That's where you get the information. The other one would be public institutions. Public institutions are your schools, your hospitals, your community centers, your banks, those are the ones who are, those are the people who from 9 to 5, the police department, those public institutions that are in your community, the economic institutions, the banks, and physical space. Physical space is absolutely important. How do you look at physical space in your community? Oftentimes you have all these open spaces, abandoned buildings or whatever that looked like, but people can get creative on how you look at open space, green space. Okay. So we saw an asset map that was needs-based. Now we're looking at it from an asset. Exercise later on that has to deal with this, but everybody has a gift. Everybody has a gift, and it's a gift of the head, the hand, and the heart. And it's important that we realize that people have these gifts. They have these gifts. The gift of the head is knowledge, information. You know people like that. You know. Who could just spew out data? You know, he was a basketball junkie. He could give you basketball statistics back in the day of Elgin Baylor and Lou Alcindor before he was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. That's that knowledge. People who know history, people who know, you know, who's just inclined to just give you mathematical equations, and you're like, wow. So there's gifts of the hand, people who are practical, people who know how to build things. Mechanics, right? Florists, people who can make those funky little flower things come into really interesting designs. People who sew, you know. So the gifts of the hand, so to really recognize people who has that gift. And gifts of the heart, the people who have empathy, people who have passion, people who listen well. I know you know people who listen well. You know somebody who listens well? Right. That's a gift. Oftentimes people just don't listen, right? That's a real gift, to really find that. So, next. Okay, associations we talked about. They're not paid, they generally live in a community. Next. How do you look at schools and assets? We go next. Alright, so here's the crazy piece. This is the conspiracy theory that I this is my conspiracy. So we elect officials in these communities, right? We elect politicians. And politicians often get elected because they are addressing the needs in communities, right? So I'm getting elected because I'm bringing in all these resources. Perceived resources. And so a lot of times politicians, if you go into communities, they play up the severity of the problem, right? And so the problem becomes much more than what it probably is because they want to get reelected. And I'm not just using politicians, it could be community leaders, right? And the local leadership is judged by how many resources they're bringing in, how many agencies they're bringing into the community. And what happens to the community after that? I'm just throwing it out there. When you're bringing in all these resources and you're bringing in folks who's addressing the need, what do you think happens to folk in the community? I mentioned it early on.
Sort of makes the best of the descriptor of their community
now. Yeah. Anything else?
Dependency,
excellent, yeah.
That's what
you're going to say? Yeah, exactly. And it goes back to what I was saying before, which they become clients. They become clients.
I have a question. Doesn't the organization or the nonprofit also have dependencies on foundations or the government or, you know, assets.
Absolutely. And so that's what I meant. There's that whole sort of cyclical gravy train that happens. And we'll talk about that. We'll talk about the welfare state, you know, and that's part of that. Absolutely. All right. So people in communities start, when people in communities start to believe what the leaders are saying, they themselves see themselves as deficient, and you guys just mentioned that. So the communities no longer act like citizens. Instead, they begin to act like clients or, worse yet, consumers. So, and I'm not painting, I don't want to paint a drastic bleak picture, because all of you guys hopefully maybe will be involved or engaged in nonprofits that are doing wonderful work. But I do want us to be critical thinkers around what that looks like. You know, as we work in communities, oftentimes we are addressing the need. So there's no incentive to be producers. You're just a client. You're a consumer. So another consequence of the approach is local groups begin to deal more with external than internal. So what does that look like when you start, if I live in the community and I just want to deal with folk from the outside, what do you think? What do you think happens? Or what does that look like? It looks like people, you don't have a belief that people in your community can solve their own problems. That you always need somebody from the outside to come and save the day. You almost begin to consume. I do a lot of research, what I call participatory action research. And so we go into communities where, you know, a lot of times it's almost savior, that there's a mentality that, okay, DePaul's coming in, we're bringing in students, we're gonna save the day. And then the residents to sort of step back and let the DePaul students do everything, right? And that's kind of a crazy way. I'm not saying that that always happens, but I've seen that happen, you know. I never forget, too, another time, I think, I forgot where I was, but the situation was where I had a bunch of high school kids when we were in, I think we were in Senegal or somewhere, and we were in a school. And everybody, all our students were painting. And the kids, and the whole idea was to have everybody work together. And so the kids from the village just watched us like it was a show. And it was the most bizarre sort of scene, right? And so they just sort of surrounded the school, literally, like almost like three deep, and watched us like we was a freak show. And here we were thinking that we were helping the community, we were, you know, but not one of those kids picked up a paintbrush to help. It was an interesting phenomenon, you know, and I learned a lot from that. It was many moons ago, but it's, again, it's like, you know, that whole savior mentality. Again, only the outside experts can provide. Funding is made available, now this is a big issue, funding is made available on the basis of needs rather than integrated approaches. So if I could show need, we're going to talk about funding a lot. You're going to go to funders and you're going to do your own mapping of how you get your funding for your own organization. But really understand that funding is really based on a criteria of need, not on integrated approaches, meaning that how community can help, how other people can be a part of the solution, but actually how are you going to be the solution? How are you going to fix it? Based off the need. The bulk of funding tends to go to institutions filling the needs. Perversely, these institutions begin to develop a vested interest in maintaining that approach. That's huge. Institutions begin to develop a vested interest in maintaining this approach, meaning that if you have a nonprofit and all that you're doing is educational enrichment, say that you're doing educational enrichment in Gage Park High School. Gage Park High School is a level three school that's not making the cut. It's in Marquette Park, and all of a sudden, you know, it becomes a level one school, it succeeds. They don't need you anymore, right? Ultimately, I mean, that's what you will want, right? But that means your funding stops as well, because there's not a need, right? So your work has been successful, this population is now succeeding, but understanding now that this institution is not, your institution is not gonna get funded because that need is no longer there. So am I saying that there's maliciousness around not-for-profits to keep this sort of cyclical approach to folk who, you know, who are in need? No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that people don't get into that for that intention, but understand that there is, very much is a money train that's connected to all of this. It's, you know, you need courses. So it's like the schoolhouse to jailhouse pipeline in some regards. All right. Lastly, you can't do this alone. Social capital is huge, and then you'll be building this within your own organization. Ingredients of social capital is trust, building real relationships, having shared values, really looking at resources critically, mutual understanding, and have a sense of community. I know this is sort of an open, how many people in here are sociology students or not? Okay, so this is like the buzzword in sociology. Social capital. Sometimes it's overused, but it's very real because you can't really do things if you can't build trust, right? And that's even within your own non-for-profit. So building trust is absolutely critical. Having reciprocal relationships. Relationships don't happen one way, they happen both ways. Having shared values. Having resources. Mutual understanding of an issue. And a sense of community that you built. Okay? Jeff? Okay, when people discover all this is my zinger, they find power. When people join together in connections and relationships, they build power. When people become productive together, they exercise their power to address problems, they realize their own dreams. I think that's it. That's it. Yeah. So, I just gave you like the real short version of ABCD. And the reason why I wanted to do that and go through this is because that's the baseline of how the work that I hope that you understand, the baseline of how nonprofits operate sometimes in communities. And I don't care what community you're dealing with, I mean, but having an understanding of ABCD will help you to really build a sound, sustainable organization. That's just my belief, particularly if we're going into communities of quote unquote needs. Any questions? I know I threw a lot of stuff up here, man. Any questions? Any comments? How many people have heard of ABCD? Asset-based analysis. Good. How does this sound? Absolutely foreign? Absolutely sort of, it sounds foreign, right? Does it?
I mean, I've never had a non-profit class.
Right.
I mean, well, it sounds, doesn't seem like foreign concept. It just seems
right.
Foreign
right.
Vocabulary.
Yeah. And I think I don't want to seem controversial, but I do want to seem controversial because I think there, you go into a lot of communities, overlap with services. Like, you just did these exercises, and you were struck by, like, you know? And so you have 10 organizations doing the same thing, getting federal money, right? Based off the data that we're getting from DePaul, they're using DePaul data to get funding from a foundation, from the Polk Brothers, from Chicago Community Trust, overlapping. And so if you did that in another country, they'd call that colonialism, right? You know, so there's interesting sort of ways of thinking about this. And I'm not saying not-for-profits are, they're a wonderful thing. They really, you know, we'll talk about that. But I want us to have a critique around it. I want us to look a little behind the curtains a little bit, you know, and really begin to look at our role, if indeed we're going to work in one, or if we're going to start one, what does that look like for us personally? You know, and understanding how money is generated and how people can get lost. Get lost. You know, one of the things that happens in nonprofits is that, and I've ran enough of them, good, bad, and ugly, that you start out with something very noble. This is what I want to do, and I'm going to change this. Then, excuse my language, shit happens, right? I need money in order for this. I need money for my staff, right? Funding sources change, relationships change, staff acting crazy, right? So you start running this like a business model, because guess what? The funders don't—they want business model type of results. They want deliverables. They want outcomes. And so my staff wasn't trained to do those sort of things. They're social workers. They're not business people. And so that whole thing changes. So you got this whole kind of, and you know, and it becomes absolutely, it could be debilitating. I've seen great organizations. I'm going to be bringing in two legendary organizations that folded last year, if they come in. And they were at one point, Southwest Youth Collaborative, if I can get to the founder, was the Seminole, was the organization around youth organizing in the United States. And their literature, I mean, they use those their tactics as literature and case studies. You know, so they're absolutely legendary. They folded last year, you know. And I can go on and on and on around these great organizations that folded. And, you know, part of it is around, well, I'll let Camille Day talk about that. But it's really, it would be very interesting to hear this noble organization that was making millions of dollars, I was on the board, and we had at one point maybe $3 million budget. So how does an organization with a $3 million budget fold? I'm just saying. So, anyway, any questions, any comments? Okay. Why don't we do this? Why don't we take 10 minutes, come back around 2:20. And by that time, our speakers should be here, hopefully. Give water, splash water.